Pacifica reporters against censorship. This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, December 15, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The world awoke Sunday morning to the news that the American armed forces had captured former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. We go to Iraq to hear Iraqi react. We travel into the Arab world where the reaction is mixed, and we go to Capitol Hill for the latest. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Two suicide bombers exploded cars outside Iraqi police stations today, killing 9 Iraqis and wounding 22. The bombings followed a car bomb attack yesterday that killed 17 people. That attack occurred just 12 hours after the former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein was pulled from an underground hovel in northern Iraq. Hussein is being held in an undisclosed location. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says the captured former Iraqi dictator will have the protections that are accorded to prisoners of war under the Geneva Conventions. Officials say Hussein continues to deny his government had weapons of mass destruction or ties to al-Qaeda. The current president of Iraq's governing council says he believes Saddam Hussein could face the death penalty when he goes on trial under the recently established Iraqi War Crimes Tribunal. However, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International argue that the provisions of the tribunal law, made largely under the influence of the United States, are flawed and lack essential elements to ensure legitimate and credible trials. Russia today played down the importance of the capture of Hussein. Deputy Foreign Minister Yuri Fedotov called the move a mainly symbolic event and said the arrest does not significantly change the situation in Iraq. Iran's government said today it's preparing a criminal complaint to present at any international court that may try Saddam Hussein over the 1980 through 1988 Iran-Iraq war. Iran has long held that the United States and Western European countries armed Saddam against Iran, which, after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, was perceived as the larger regional threat by the West. We'll have more on developments later in the broadcast. Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf narrowly escaped an explosion detonated by unknown terrorists. Masroor Hussein reports from Islamabad.
No group has claimed responsibility for the attack. Musharraf's motorcade had hardly crossed a bridge, his official residence near Islamabad, when a huge blast blew it up. Eyewitnesses say they heard heavy firing after the blast, which shattered windows in a nearby suburb. Some eyewitnesses say the firing was directed at the motorcade carrying Musharraf. 6 people have been detained in connection with the blast, according to police sources. In a recent video message, Osama bin Laden urged Muslims in Pakistan to kill Musharraf, who chose to abandon the Taliban regime of neighboring Afghanistan and back the US-led war against Osama bin Laden's organization. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Masroor Hussein in Islamabad.
A new GAO report finds that the United States is still struggling to prevent the flow of money to terrorist groups. From Washington, D.C., Brandi Howell.
The Congressional General Accounting Office released a report Sunday that found that the U.S. is still struggling to prevent the flow of money to terrorist groups. The report said that these terrorist groups have increased the use of alternative financing mechanisms, such as filtering money through charities or laundering by selling gems and similar commodities through the black market to fund their efforts. The GAO recommends more investigations concerning these financing mechanisms. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Brandi Howell.
The U.S. Supreme Court today said it will hear an appeal from the Bush administration. The White House wants to make certain that secret documents from Vice President Dick Cheney's task force remain a secret. Erica McDonald reports from Houston.
A lawsuit filed in 2001 by environmental and watchdog groups seeks to force the Bush administration to provide details about who participated in the energy talks and whether the vice president's involvement, in light of Cheney's Halliburton ties, create a conflict of interest. A lower court sided with plaintiffs Judicial Watch and the Sierra Club in July, citing the public's right to know. The administration's appeal cites a constitutional need for the president to receive candid advice, which requires confidentiality. The advice that informed Bush energy policy calls for millions in coal, nuclear, and natural gas subsidies, and drilling on public lands like the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. The Supreme Court will hear the administration's appeal next spring, with a ruling expected later that summer. From KPFT in Houston, Texas, I'm Erica McDonald for Free Speech Radio News.
Performer Lauryn Hill made a political statement about the sex scandal that rocked the Catholic Church during an appearance at the Vatican. Amma Boadi has more.
Multiple Grammy Award-winning singer and activist Lauryn Hill stood on stage in front of thousands at a special concert held at the Vatican. She accused the Catholic Church of exploitation and moral corruption, urging members of the church to repent. She said, quote, "I'm not here to celebrate, like you, the birth of Christ, but to ask you why you are not mourning for his death in this place." She continued, "Holy God has witnessed the corruption of your leadership, of the exploitation and abuses which are the minimum that can be said for the clergy." Representatives of the Catholic Church labelled the statement as a rash and disrespectful outburst, and according to news reports, Hill did not perform the song she was expected to, but instead sang a protest song. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Amma Boadi.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
The world awoke Sunday morning to the news that the American armed forces had captured former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. We begin our coverage in Iraq. First, we hear from our correspondent Urban Hamid, who's been talking to many Iraqis gauging their reaction to the capture.
There are mixed feelings. People are, of course, extremely relieved and happy. But at the same time, with the ongoing terror that has happened, you know, the bombings and whatnot, people are saddened by that, because I think initially they thought that everything was going to be all right. And the other thing is, they still are facing the same problems. The economy is really bad. The electricity is still not working. Telephones are not working. Infrastructure is not working. People are unemployed. People don't have any money. People do not get paid. And I think this makes it so much more difficult for them to deal with the situation.
Urban Hamid joining us from Baghdad. We go now to CorpWatch Managing Director and FSRN reporter Prothap Chatterjee, who was in Basra when the news broke inside Iraq.
First, we thought the news wasn't true, but very soon after that, we heard Kalashnikovs being fired off rapidly, and we realized that the news had spread. And when we went out of the hospital, there were people dancing in the street. Basra is in southern Iraq, and it's Shia territory, and so a lot of people in the south hated Saddam Hussein, and so there was a lot of jubilation as a result of his capture.
Now, you traveled into Baghdad after hearing the news. Tell us about the journey, and tell us about arriving in Baghdad.
We were a little apprehensive when we drove up from Basra. We weren't sure exactly, you know, what the security situation would be. And as far as we could see, things were pretty calm once we arrived here in Baghdad. So there has been a lot of jubilation, but there's also been a lot of anger, especially in a part of Baghdad called Adamiya, where Saddam Hussein was last seen. He was last seen outside a mosque called Al-Imam Al-Adam, and people there were demonstrating in the streets in support of Saddam. There was a man, you know, wearing a mock suicide bomb and a rocket launcher, saying that they would, you know, still die for Saddam. And I understand in Tikrit, Saddam's hometown where he was captured, there was a lot of anger too. So there's a lot of apprehension, whereas the Americans say that this will mean that the security situation will get better. There's a lot of people who don't think that that's going to be true, that people will still continue the attack.
So, Prothap, we've also seen Al Jazeera reporting today and some of the other Arab press that this has been a great humiliation, in part, to see the Iraqi leader arrested this way, to have his beard shaven by the enemy. What kind of a sense are you getting from people? Is it a humiliation?
I think it very much is a humiliation. I mean, in the Middle East, saving face is extremely important. And people even here that we've spoken to who used to be high up in Saddam Hussein's government have said it was important for them to see the Americans leave with saving face, and to see their former leader lose face in front of Americans is really kind of a very difficult situation for people, especially those that are loyal to Saddam Hussein. So it's very possible people want to take revenge. But the other thing is that, especially here in Baghdad, because the situation of people is so bad, even people who are against Saddam Hussein and for the occupation, you know, in the last 8 months, there's no water, there's no electricity, there's no sewage. The resentment is building, even among people who didn't like Saddam Hussein.
Prathap, let me ask you, what is the sense of the public debate or discourse right now around the possibility of holding a trial for Saddam Hussein in Iraq? Is that a real possibility? Are people talking about that?
That's the discussion is that he needs to face the Iraqi public. Today, people were speculating that he's going to be taken to France, which seems extremely unlikely. But people are really don't know what's going to happen next. They assume that the United States is going to call the shots in terms of a trial of Saddam Hussein.
Prathap Chatterjee, managing editor of CorpWatch, speaking to us there from Baghdad. Meanwhile, Arabs had mixed reaction to the news. Ulla Farawati has more from Jordan.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
U.S. Chief Administrator in Baghdad Paul Bremer's announcement was followed up by U.S. President Bush a few hours later from the White House.
In the history of Iraq, a dark and painful era is over. A hopeful day has arrived.
The news of the capture of former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein struck a deep chord in the Arab street. But unlike the general public rapture that greeted the capture of Hussein, Arabs here reacted with shock. Wafa is a Syrian housewife who lives in Jordan.
This is very bad. How can they treat him that way on TV? He was a tyrant, I know, but they were searching him in a very humiliating way. He was examined as if he was an animal.
The video footage of the man known as the Butcher of Baghdad sent shivers around the Arab world, with people here expressing astonishment. The deposed president surrendered easily, looking haggard and compliant. They recalled the many times Hussein called on Arab news satellite channels for the Arab people to resist the occupation. Fahed is a Jordanian accountant.
He swore before the war that Iraqis would fight America, and then he didn't fire a single shot. We expected him to commit suicide. Resist, try to escape, do anything instead of hiding like a rat and then surrendering cheaply.
U.S. President George W. Bush said the deposed Iraqi leader Hussein would be tried before a special Iraqi war tribunal as a war criminal. But many suspect the objectivity of the tribunal because it's formed and controlled by the U.S. forces. Zaki Hafiz is member of the Iraqi Bar Association. He spoke to Al Jazeera TV.
Hussein should be referred to the United Nations. He should be tried before an international criminal court and not by the U.S.-controlled tribunal. He should be tried fairly and not by those who have personal grudges against him.
Meanwhile, many here reacted with joy at the capture of the leader who controlled Iraq with a blood-stained iron fist. However, they expressed anger and sadness that the toppling of Saddam's regime came at the hands of the foreigners. Saddam Hussein, they said, was replaced by thousands of American soldiers. Iraq, they added, is not yet free. In Amman, Jordan, I am Ulla Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Time magazine is reporting that Saddam Hussein has told interrogators that the United States fabricated the weapons of mass destruction charge to create a reason to invade the country. Meanwhile, President Bush told reporters that the U.S. will work with the Iraqi people to set up a trial for Hussein that will stand up to international scrutiny. President Bush also said the capture of Hussein does not necessarily affect how long U.S. troops will remain in the occupied country. Mitch Jeserich has this report from Washington, D.C.
At the Eisenhower Executive Office building in Washington, D.C., President Bush indicated that Saddam Hussein, the deposed Iraqi dictator who is allegedly responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, will be tried in Iraq.
I think what that needs to happen is he needs to be brought to justice. And the Iraqi citizens need to be very much involved in the development of a system that brings him to justice. And there needs to be a public trial, and all the atrocities need to come out. And justice needs to be delivered, and I'm confident it will be done in a fair way.
However, international law and human rights groups are concerned as to whether Iraq, whose new leaders have been appointed by the coalition authority, are able to set up such a judicial system that will unveil the entire truth of Saddam Hussein's oppressive regime. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C.
Those war crimes, and they are indeed war crimes, were not committed in a vacuum, and they were not committed alone. They were committed with the help of many others around the world, including many in several U.S. administrations. The provision of chemical warheads, chemical materials for chemical weapons, the material for biological weapons, which came directly from the United States, the involvement of people like Donald Rumsfeld in trying to work with Saddam Hussein's regime at the height of some of the worst human rights atrocities. These things are not likely to come out. They're not likely to emerge.
Bennis calls on the transfer of Hussein to the international community where the death penalty is less likely.
If Saddam Hussein is held in U.S. custody and is brought to trial in a hearing that is controlled by the U.S., whether it has an Iraqi face or not, there is a serious danger that there could be a kind of plea bargain in which Saddam Hussein could be told, if you tell us what we want to hear, regardless of whether it's true or not, we will make sure you don't get the death penalty. And that could include claims about so-called ties with Al-Qaeda, so-called evidence of weapons of mass destruction, so-called support for terrorism, all the things that the U.S. would love to hear from Saddam Hussein to give credibility to their going to war.
President Bush also indicated today that the capture of Hussein does not mean that the occupied country will be handed over to the Iraqis or that troops will be ordered home anytime soon. He says that will depend on whether the resistance continues.
You can count on America remaining until the job is done. It's important for them to hear that, because there will probably be some that will continue to test our will. You know, they'll try to kill in hopes that we will flee.
Protests demanding elections for a new Iraqi government are on the rise as the popular Shia cleric, the Ayatollah Ali Sistani, said there is no obstacle to holding direct elections. Chris Townsing, the executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project, says that such demands could increase now that the threat of Saddam Hussein is gone.
Perhaps many more Iraqis will not see that possible return as something that scares them away from the U.S. occupation ending. So it's possible that this capture could actually intensify and broaden the Iraqi opposition to U.S. occupation and turn it from more of a passive resistance into a more active resistance expressed in various ways.
Democratic congressional member Bernie Sanders is calling on Bush to use the capture of Hussein as an opportunity to internationalize the occupation of Iraq and to pull the U.S. forces out. Sanders also says it's important not to let the capture of Hussein overshadow some of the negative news from the region, including a recent Defense Department report showing that Halliburton's Kellogg Brown & Root has overcharged $61 million in gasoline prices.
You can't deny the importance of capturing a guy who was a terrible dictator who killed a whole lot of people. But you cannot also, while you're looking at that issue, have the media only concentrate on that and ignore the fact that the President of the United States is not allowing other countries to bid on contracts to rebuild Iraq, that you have companies like Halliburton who are doing nothing else but doing war profiteering. They are making outrageous profits at the expense of the American taxpayer while they're doing work in Iraq. So there's a lot to be looked at.
I'm Mitch Jezrich for Free Speech Radio News.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. In other news, strong concerns were expressed at the World Summit on Information Society in Switzerland by civil society groups and organizations over just how serious the United Nations and member states really are about including them in policy formulation and planning. Civil society representatives say vital issues that affect us all are simply not being addressed at the summit. A key area of concern is what they see as the failure to address inequality and poverty and to ensure that infrastructures are in place to protect democracy before farming out communications to the private sector and the highest bidder. Naomi Fowler brings us this report from Geneva.
Communication by a massive network is very unique because it allows us to work from virtually anywhere in the world.
There was a vast array of shining, high-tech, governmental, private sector and NGO stalls last week at the Top Security World Summit on the Information Society. The United Nations said they wanted to address issues arising from what it calls The fundamental transformation as the industrial society that marked the 20th century rapidly gives way to the information society of the 21st century. The United Nations says it wants to initiate global discussion on these changes to benefit what it refers to as the world community. But for the majority of the planet's population, who do not even have access to a telephone, this information society is not something they are a part of.
Les invitamos a escuchar este y todos los sábados a las 10 de la mañana el programa Los Cumiches.
Ese programa de la nueva generación Cumiche.
¡Les esperamos!
These are the sounds of Los Cumiches, children's community radio in Nicaragua. They are exercising their human right to communicate, supposed to be protected by the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. It's people-centered initiatives like this one that civil society participation in the summit say must be given priority in policy making and not be swept aside in an uncritical rush towards computer technologies to the benefit of corporations and a tiny information elite. If not, they say, we will all suffer. Civil society representatives and organizations held what were referred to as side events at the summit. The World Forum on Communication Rights claimed it would tackle the issues that the World Summit on the Information Society dares not. Sally Birch from the Latin American Information Agency was involved in this summit preparatory sessions.
My interpretation is that governments develop policy, private sector puts the money, and civil society gives it legitimacy. Decreasing social divides means addressing fundamental causes and much more than just the technology. And it has to do with how information's managed, who controls the technology, who controls the information, training, and et cetera, and et cetera.
Why are we hiding poverty in the United States of America?
Cherry Honkala is a homeless single mother with the Economic Human Rights Campaign.
I'll tell you why. Because we have been made to disappear. Disappear from every television, every printed paper, billboard, and radio station.
Leading anti-poverty Indian journalist Palagumi Sainath.
It's a worldwide thing. It's not just India. It's not just Africa. It's a worldwide assault on the poor. And the media are at the forefront of it.
World Forum on Communication Rights coordinator Shauna Siakru of Communication in the Information Society.
The reality is that telecommunication investment has slowed down. That particular paradigm has reached its limits as far as it can go in terms of allowing people access. And those limits are determined by very narrow profit paradigms. Therefore, we need new ideas. There is nothing impossible and or unsustainable about communities building and owning their own networks.
The consensus among civil society participants was that their work is cut out for them to get their voices heard in the fight towards a more equitable, people-centred approach to communication. They continue to work together in the run-up to the next phase in 2005. This is Naomi Fowler in Geneva for Free Speech Radio News.
This weekend marked the second anniversary of the attack on the Indian Parliament, which the Indian government claimed was the work of, quote, Pakistani Muslim terrorists. Yet 2 years on, it's still not known who is responsible for the attack. Last year, India's post-911 terrorism court tried and found guilty three suspects, sentencing them all to death. But the High Court of India last month acquitted one man, Delhi University professor S.A.R. Giuliani. He was behind bars for 2 years and was given two death penalties. When Mr. Giuliani was first standing trial 2 years ago, FSRN reported on his repeated protests of innocence, including the worldwide outcry from writers and intellectuals such as Noam Chomsky and Arundhati Roy, who came to his defence. Mr. Giuliani is now out of jail, and our correspondent Vinod K. Jose obtained this recorded conversation between Mr. Giuliani and his lawyer Nandita Haksa.
Syed Abdul Rahman Gilani is a victim of the war against terrorism. 2 years ago, he was charged with waging war against Indian state and conspiracy and was booked under the Draconian Prevention of Terrorism Act, or POTA. Gilani, a professor and scholar of Arabic studies at Delhi University, was born in the disputed territory of Kashmir. Gilani spent 2 years on death row. The government, media, and others labeled him a terrorist. His 8-year-old and 4-year-old children were denied school admission. His family was thrown out from their rented house in Delhi. This is a conversation between Gilani and his lawyer, Nandita Haksa.
Well, tell me, how do you really feel about the judge?
I feel that High Court hasn't done justice fully. On one hand, they have freed an innocent man. But on the other hand, they haven't passed any strictures on those policemen who framed this innocent man. And they haven't passed any strictures on lower court who sentenced to death an innocent man without any proof.
Okay. I don't think any judgment can be looked at purely legally. I don't think decisions are taken because of evidence and non-evidence. Judgments are always a reflection of a politics.
Yeah.
And perhaps the lack of strictures that have been passed is a reflection of today's politics.
Yeah.
And maybe the reason why they haven't been able to pass, yeah, or they have felt that they should not pass strictures against the police, mm, or the designated court, is because they feel that somehow they will be anti-national or unpatriotic. For instance, you were saying that there are another 100 Kashmiri prisoners, mm, in Tihar jail. Do you think that this judgment can help them in any way?
Well, in that way, this judgment is a disastrous one, because it then stops that kind of struggle, democratic struggle, which must go on. And you are allowing that the democratic institutions like judiciary to be politicized, allowing to dehumanize the police forces, security forces.
India, US and Israel,
mm,
are playing the leading roles in this so-called war against terrorism.
Mm.
And I think your death penalty, you were one of the first victims of this.
Yeah.
So now the question of furthering the struggle is not only within human rights,
mm,
but it's to probably expose this war against terrorism.
Yeah.
In the end, the police gets more impunity, the executive gets more powers.
Mm-hmm.
And it undermines the entire concept of democracy.
I feel this whole process is not to, it's not just war against terrorism. What it is to curb the voice of human rights. It's to curb that, you know, aspirations of the people.
Mm.
This is what is going on throughout. What Israel is doing in Palestine, what America is doing in Iraq, and what Indian state is doing in Kashmir, in Northeast. They are curbing the aspirations of the people. They are curbing that people's voice.
You haven't asked for compensation,
mm,
personally,
mm,
and you haven't asked for damages, which I think as a lawyer I would say that you have a right to. But you didn't ask for it personally. But why did you not?
It's not just personal thing, you know. I feel that a movement should grow from this. It's not just you compensate over one person and the case is over. This should generate a movement to put an end to this process, dehumanizing of police forces, violation of human rights, politicizing of judiciary, and just asking for damages for a person is not enough.
From New Delhi in India, I am Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Kata Mesta and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. The technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Million, and Lindsay Benedict. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.